This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. In 1974, a New Hampshire police officer gave a citation to a driver over a problem with his license plate, an unusual beginning to a pivotal story about free speech.
We were going home from shopping. I was getting into my car. I had a blue Toyota. The police officer was writing me up with a summons.
My name is Brian Robbins, and at the time, I was a patrolman for the city of Lebanon, New Hampshire. I remember giving a summons out to Mr. Maynard for covering up a portion of his license plate sometime in the early 70s.
I cover up the Live Free or Die slogan with a red tape, a reflecting tape.
And he'd violated the law at that point.
The First Amendment protects freedom of speech in straightforward terms, but it's taken centuries to define how those protections work, particularly through the Supreme Court. The driver was named George Maynard, and the court's ruling on that citation affects us today. Maynard's story is told in a new podcast called Unprecedented. It's produced by WAMU, the station that also produces 1A. Joining us in studio are the hosts of Unprecedented, Mike Vuolo and Matthew Schwartz. Mike, Matt, welcome to 1A.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Mike, let's begin with how you found George Maynard 45 years after that summons. What did he tell you about why he covered up the state motto on his license plate with a piece of tape?
Maynard attributes his repudiation of that phrase, live free or die, to what he calls his Christian conscience and to being a Jehovah's Witness. His interpretation of biblical scripture is at odds with the slogan. Beyond that, I think I will let him explain.
I oppose the slogan for religious reasons. My Christian conscience won't allow me to support that. My main belief is to live under a righteous rule, God's kingdom. In Revelation, he tells us that he will do away with sickness, pain, and sorrow. And so this is the government that I'm looking for. We can see the world is in a bad condition.
You know, George Maynard covered up his license plate slogan in 1974. And in 1974, America wasn't exactly paradise. We had Watergate, the oil crisis. We had the serial killer Ted Bundy, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst.
There's a lot of hatred in this world. But under God's kingdom, there won't be any at all. So that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to support Live Free or Die, because I'd rather be in bondage and alive and worshiping my God and give him praises. And if I'm dead, I can't do that.
You can hear from George Maynard's own words that while he's living in the present, he's more or less living for the future, a future when all governments, including the state of New Hampshire, including all earthbound governments, are replaced by God's kingdom, which is the one true government and the one to which Maynard has pledged his allegiance.
So Mr. Maynard went out, bought some tape, covered up the motto he didn't agree with, and that was illegal?
Yeah. In New Hampshire, there was a law at the time that said you can't cover up or obscure any of the numbers or letters on a license plate. The exact language said that it was a misdemeanor to, quote, knowingly to obscure the figures or letters on any number plate, which is a license plate. And the state Supreme Court interpreted that to mean all the letters on the license plate, including the state motto.
So he gets fined, but the story does not end there. I mean, he could have theoretically, Mike, just paid the fine and gone on with his life.
He could have, but then he wouldn't be George Maynard, right? He would be Joshua Johnson or me. He'd be driving around. He thought, you know, this idea of driving around as a mobile billboard, effectively, advertising Live Free or Die, was something that he just couldn't do. And that's the very essence of moral conviction.
They fined me $25 suspended, but I got arrested again because I kept the tape on. They found me guilty again and then fined me a $50 fine.
I believe he refused to pay and the judge sentenced him to some time in the House of Correction.
If I paid the fine, I would be admitting my guilt. I said, I'm not guilty of any wrongdoing. So what they did, they sentenced me for 15 days in jail to pay the fine.
I mean, he could have paid the fine and be done with it, but he refused to pay.
So the 15 days in jail, was that the only price he paid for refusing to remove the tape or pay the fines?
Joshua, that was just the beginning. The state also confiscated his plates so he couldn't drive, which meant that he couldn't work. He lost his job at a print shop, and he was devastated. And he channeled that despair into action. He sued the Sheriff's Department of Lebanon, New Hampshire, for violating his First Amendment rights.
So clearly George Maynard is a man of his convictions. Here he is talking a little bit more about his background.
I was born in West Warwick, Rhode Island in 1932. I was mostly an orphan boy because my mother died when I was 3 years old. They put me in an orphanage until I was 7 years old, and I was put in boarding school. When I got 18 years old, I went into the service. I was a paratrooper, and I was shipped over to Korea when they first broke out the war. I spent 11 months in Korea, and I returned home with frozen feet, and I was discharged in Massachusetts, Fort Devens. But in 1952, I met my wife, and we decided to get married, and she was a blessing. It was God sent for me.
Mike, he seems like a pretty mild-mannered guy, not a firebrand or a free speech crusader.
No, not at all. And in fact, I would describe Maynard as passionate. He's as passionate today, it seems to me, as he was about this issue, I'm guessing, back in the mid-70s. But you're right, he's not the guy you would expect to see with a sandwich board and a megaphone on the front lines of a protest movement. And if you think about it, this case is about Maynard's right to remain silent, not to speak. And he wants to remain silent on this choice, essentially, between living free or dying. He doesn't want to be a megaphone, not for that.
And his beliefs there are actually in line with the teachings of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you look at the history of important Supreme Court decisions in our country, Jehovah's Witnesses have been behind a lot of those, especially when it comes to compelling speech. There was a famous case in World War II where the Supreme Court ruled that you can't force somebody to salute the flag during the Pledge of Allegiance. That was brought by Jehovah's Witnesses. In 2002, Jehovah's Witnesses went to the Supreme Court because there was a law saying you had to get a permit to go door to door. And the Supreme Court said, no, the First Amendment gives you the right to go door to door without having to get government permission first. So George Maynard was just following in this tradition of Jehovah's Witnesses taking a stand, in the process being penalized, going to jail, and the irony of losing his freedom because of refusing to say live free or die was not lost on Mr. Maynard.
It's a strange thing that a person that is a war veteran has to end up in jail because he refused to be dictated to and refused to say live free or die. In Germany, people who refused to say Heil Hitler, they were put in concentration camps. But in the state of New Hampshire, they put you in jail. That's not freedom. That's dictatorship. You know, for a state to deprive a man to earn a living and to support and provide the needs of the family.
Hello? Hello?
I'm sorry. I got emotional. I'm shedding some tears right now because
I'm sorry, Mr. Maynard.
My family, my family suffered unjustly. Yeah. I get emotional just thinking of it. One of my daughters was 8 years old, and she's 54 now. This happened 40 years ago, but it still hurts to know that those poor kids were suffering. They went to a drama to see their father, to go to jail. That is a terrible thing to experience. And this state should be ashamed of themselves for bringing a hardship to a family that wasn't deserving just to promote a slogan.
Mike, all these years later, you can tell how strongly he feels about this and the effect the experience had on him. Were you caught off guard at all by how emotional Mr. Maynard got?
Frankly, I'm a little embarrassed by my reaction that you heard on that tape. I was so clueless that I thought the phone cut out. And here I am saying, hello, hello, and he's not able to speak because he's sobbing. I was caught off guard, and I'm not at all surprised, though, because Maynard has a very starkly delineated sense of right and wrong. You have to, in order to take on a fight like this and take it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Well, in just a minute, we'll talk about what happened when his case did make it to the Supreme Court. We're speaking with Mike Vuolo and Matthew Schwartz, the hosts of the new podcast, Unprecedented. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
The New Hampshire boys, Steve and Joe, have gone beyond, doing it for life.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking with Matthew Schwartz and Mike Vuolo about their new podcast, Unprecedented. The first episode focuses on the case of George Maynard, a New Hampshire man who was fined $25 for covering the state motto, Live Free or Die, on his license plate. We'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about the Supreme Court cases that have defined freedom of speech, comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's step away from George Maynard's case. We'll get back to the Supreme Court in just a second. But first, Mike, what made you to decide to make this podcast?
I would say that the seed was first planted for me probably about 15 years ago when I was sitting in the First Amendment law class in Columbia Journalism School. It was taught at the time by the august Anthony Lewis, who's now deceased. And I was reading these cases about freedom of the press, which we're not focusing on in this season, and thinking that these are fascinating stories, and I feel like I'm only scratching the surface of them. So what drew me into those stories is in large part the people who are involved. In a lot of these First Amendment cases are war protesters, Klan members, they're religious zealots, they're pornographers, not necessarily people that you would count as your friends, but they were all extremely fascinating and determined. And so podcasts didn't exist at the time, but the seed was there. And I think in the last couple of years, it started to grow when I met Matt.
Matt?
You know, the genesis is so similar for me. It even happened around the same time. 15 years ago, I was sitting in law school class at Georgetown, and I remember reading these fascinating stories of people who had shaped the law. And you know, I was an adult at that point, and I had never heard these stories before. And I thought, you shouldn't have to pay tens of thousands of dollars a year to go to law school to learn these fundamental stories about our nation's democracy and our justice system and how we have the rights that we have. You know, people know that the First Amendment basically has 10 words on free speech. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. But those 10 words mean nothing without people, regular Americans who push the boundaries of what they can say. In the process, taking their fight all the way to the Supreme Court and ensuring the rights for all of us. So I wanted to tell those stories.
Mike, your first episode comes out today, right?
That's right. New episodes come out every Wednesday on the NPR One app or whichever app you use to get your podcasts.
And there will be 8 episodes total, each on a different Supreme Court case. Why start with George Maynard's case?
That's a good question. We wrestled with what to start with. And for me, it was the idea that the First Amendment has a lot of counterintuitive ideas wrapped up in it. And if you were to ask the average person, what does the First Amendment mean? They might say it means I have the right to say whatever I want to say. But as you see from the Maynard case, it also means that we have the right not to speak, not to say things. And so I wanted to start with something that was counterintuitive, and also this idea of compelled speech when the government tries to force someone to say something. It comes up more often than you think. It actually comes up every 5, 6, 7 years at the Supreme Court. And the second episode will be another compelled speech case from just last year, 2018.
Matt? You know, we started with the Maynard case because it sets a very important precedent on compelled speech. And when I say precedent, I mean that the Supreme Court has referred back to this cases in determining the course of action in other cases. The case that Mike just mentioned that we're talking about next week, it's from 2018. It involves religious pregnancy centers and what the state tried to force them to say. And it relies very strongly on the precedent that George Maynard helped set.
Okay, back to Mr. Maynard's case. He refuses to take the tape off his license plate, refuses to pay the fine, the state confiscates his license plate so he can't drive, and Mike, as a result, he lost his job.
Right, yeah, he lost his job, and when he sues the sheriff's department, it kicks off this legal battle that lasts for years and eventually makes it all the way to the Supreme Court.
We'll hear arguments next in Woolley against Maynard. Cone.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Matt, tell us about the case. What exactly was the constitutional issue that the Supreme Court was considering?
Okay, the specific question before the court was, can the state have a law that requires an individual driving a car on the state's roads to carry a message on that car that he or she disagrees with? Or does that sort of law violate the First Amendment? And the person you just heard was Maynard's attorney, Richard Cohn, back in 1977, arguing before the court. We talked to him recently, and here's how he summed up the main issue.
I think the crux of the matter is that in a free society, one's beliefs should be shaped by his own mind and his conscience rather than coerced by the state.
So, Matt, it sounds like a pretty simple argument that the government should not be able to force you to say anything that you just don't want to say.
It sounds like a simple argument, and the state of New Hampshire tried to preempt this entire case by saying, we don't need to bring the First Amendment into this because carrying the state motto on your license plate doesn't count as speech.
Yeah, the state's argument was basically, look, this motto is on everybody's car. So in a sense, everybody's saying it, which means nobody's saying it. In other words, nobody actually would think that Maynard believes in live free or die just because it's on his state-issued license plate. It's just a thing on his license plate.
By no stretch of the imagination can the appellees be said to agree with the state motto merely because it's required to be placed on their license plates. Nebraska, the Cornhusker state, does everyone seeing a vehicle from Nebraska reasonably believe that the registrant of that vehicle necessarily himself believes that Nebraska is a Cornhusker state, or that everyone in Nebraska is a Cornhusker?
So there's the attorney for the state of New Hampshire making that case that a motto on everyone's license plate does not count as speech because you wouldn't think that someone personally believes it since it's simply on your license plate. Mike, did the court agree with that?
Well, the point isn't whether anybody believed that Maynard himself agreed with live free or die. The point is that Maynard strongly disagrees with this statement and doesn't want it on his car. This was about what Maynard was being forced to say against his will.
And in fact, some of the justices made that very point. Here's Justice Potter Stewart.
It's compelling somebody to advertise a belief in which he doesn't believe either because of religious reasons or political or philosophical reasons.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
And on this point, the court agreed that this was speech.
So even not speaking, not expressing yourself is still a matter of free speech and free expression. So was that it? Was that case closed?
Not quite. So once we've established that this is in fact a free speech case, we can get to the heart of the issue, legally speaking. This is constitutional law 101. Here's how the Supreme Court decides a case like this. if the government wants to force Maynard to speak, it has to demonstrate that it has what's called a compelling state interest for doing so. And in plain English, all that means is that the government needs to show it has a really good reason for the law.
Yeah, the Supreme Court is saying, look, New Hampshire, you are potentially violating a fundamental constitutional right, the First Amendment, by forcing somebody to speak. We're not saying that you can't do that, but you need to convince us that you have a really good reason for doing so.
What kind of thing would count as a compelling interest, as a really good reason?
Joshua, that's the million-dollar question. And the answer I'm going to give you may sound a little unsatisfying, but here it is. A compelling interest is whatever a majority of the Supreme Court says it is.
That's clear enough. But what did the state of New Hampshire say was its compelling state interest, compelling interest in requiring everyone to display the whole license plate?
Well, the state makes two arguments.
Does your case depend upon this having been declared the motto of the state officially by the legislature?
I think, Mr. Chief Justice, that it does have some bearing, because by the legislature's having so declared this to be the official state motto, the legislature has, in effect, said that the motto is of importance to the state of New Hampshire.
So basically, because the state legislature has declared Live Free or Die the state motto, it's important.
So it's kind of important because it's important.
Exactly.
Right. It's not the strongest argument, but the state had another argument.
Secondly, the motto Live Free or Die and its requirement that it be placed upon motor vehicle license plates has to do with the registration of motor vehicles, the use of the highways, an efficient registration system of motor vehicles, and other recognizable interests of the state of New Hampshire.
So basically, what the state was arguing there is that the motto on the plates shows which cars are non-commercial passenger vehicles, which apparently is an important interest and for them. And that's why they said they needed to have the motto on all the plates.
I still am not sure why they need to distinguish between non-commercial and commercial vehicles. I think they could do so in other ways by changing the color of the plates. This seemed to me like a justification after the fact.
So we heard the arguments from Mr. Maynard and from the state of New Hampshire, but what did the Supreme Court believe?
From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Bob Edwards.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a state may not require drivers to display the state motto on a license plate. More from NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
Writing for the court, Chief Justice Warren Burger said that the First Amendment guarantee to freedom of expression entitles a person to speak freely and also not to speak at all. He said that the New Hampshire license plate law forces an individual, as part of his daily life, to be an instrument fostering public adherence to an ideological point of view.
That's NPR's Nina Totenberg reporting on the case at the time. For All Things Considered, I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Mike, what's the legacy of the Maynard decision? I mean, I've heard from some of our listeners who aren't quite sure the difference this makes. Mike tweeted, "Oh, please. Half the plates in New Hampshire have frames that impinge on the motto with Red Sox, Patriots, Bruins, or Celtics."
Well, those are choices. This was not a choice for Maynard. He was given a state-issued license plate, and he had to display it. Otherwise, he had to pay a fine, and ultimately, he went to jail. So I think the legacy of this case is, can the government in any context force you to say something, whether it's written, spoken, that you don't want to say? And not only that you don't want to say, but that fundamentally violates your conscience. And for Maynard, this was an important, you know, so important that he went to jail, lost his job, went to the Supreme Court. So I think the legacy, well, you'll see in our next episode, the legacy continues in so many other contexts, including one that involves abortion.
Matt, the title of the podcast is Unprecedented, so that highlights the concept of precedent. Just give us a little bit more Law 101 in terms of why this precedent is so important, not just in the Supreme Court, but in the context of understanding the First Amendment.
Precedent is so incredibly important. judges wear these black robes, and I worry that that gives people an impression that they're magical and they go back behind into their chambers and they stir their cauldron of justice and somehow come up with the right decision.
Like they teach at Hogwarts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's not actually how it happens. Precedent provides guidance. Precedent literally means, it comes from precede, which means before, and it basically provides guidance for the judges to know how they've decided these sorts of things before, and guidance for people and businesses to know what they can do without running afoul of the law. The reason we called it unprecedented was because when George Maynard covered up his license plate, for instance, that sort of act was unprecedented. We rely on precedent going back and continuing to go back until there's an originating action where the court has to deal with something that is unprecedented, that's never happened before. And that's who we're celebrating in all of the cases that we're discussing this season on the show, people who push the boundaries in ways that really had never been done before.
I do want to hear more about some of those cases, but I wonder whatever happened to George Maynard. Angela tweeted, "Thank you so much for this story. I hate when I cry at work, but it was so touching." Whatever became of George Maynard after this case?
Well, he lives in Connecticut now, which is the Constitution state. And I asked him when we spoke to him if he it's not in the show, not in the podcast, but I asked him if he covered up the Constitution state on his license plate, because that's what it says there. And he said he did when he first moved there, because he didn't want to support that slogan either. And he was stopped by the police, and he said, "Well, I'll have you know that I'm allowed to do this. And in fact, I'll point you to the Supreme Court case that says so." And I think they left him alone. So he lives in Connecticut. He's now in his getting on his late 80s. He lives with his wife, Maxine, who's there. And they're still Jehovah's Witnesses. They're still very deeply religious. And he's proud, I think, of the stand he took in this case.
Some of you are paying a little more attention to license plates now that we've had this conversation, including Andy, who tweeted, "I noticed Tennessee recently added the phrase 'In God We Trust' to their new license plates. Why was this added to our plates? I disagree with the decision and would like to keep church and state separate." Matt, it's interesting that this case not only deals with freedom of speech, but freedom of religion, which is also one of the five freedoms that's protected in the First Amendment: religion, speech, press, assembly, and the right to petition the government. This is that kind of interesting intersection between the two. These First Amendment cases are never quite cut and dry.
There's often an intersection between religion and speech, because religion informs people's beliefs and shows how strongly they're willing to say things or not say things. With something like In God We Trust, there's been a long history of the Supreme Court gets around that sometimes by saying it's part of our cultural heritage. It's not really forcing you to espouse that message. And in fact, we've got In God We Trust and our currency. The Supreme Court has tended to be okay with that. But these cases are not cut and dry, and it's going to continue to be difficult decisions for the justices.
Before we let you go, Mike, there are 8 episodes to this podcast. What else can we look forward to learning about?
After we talk about compelled speech, we're going to do a couple of episodes on what we're calling your constitutional right to be mean, which is a sort of colloquial way of saying intentional infliction of emotional distress. And those are going to be a great couple of episodes, because we talk about the case about Hustler versus Falwell, in which Hustler published a very, very raunchy parody of Jerry Falwell back in the 80s. But we're going to tell the story in a way and through a voice that you've never heard before. The man who actually wrote the parody, and he's never done an interview. And so we found him, and he'll be telling the story from his perspective.
Mike Volo and Matthew Schwartz, the hosts of Unprecedented, a new podcast from WAMU, the station that also produces 1A. Episode 1 is out now. Mike, Matt, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Fantastic.
You heard Nina Totenberg in that report from All Things Considered. She's in studio with us to talk more about the impact of the Maynard decision and how the Supreme Court has changed more broadly. We welcome your questions and thoughts both on the Maynard case and just about free speech law or where the Supreme Court's headed right now. 1A@WAMU.org. Stay close. We've been talking about a Supreme Court case that tested the limits of free speech. Some folks are still pushing those boundaries to this day, including some of you. Here is what Lee left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Lee, and I live in Aspen, Colorado. It's a town of less than 7,000 people. Recently, my 84-year-old mom were at a city housing meeting where they adopted a new public comment policy, and we were told that we could not criticize city housing. We both did, and subsequently I was removed from the room, and this happened several meetings, by a police officer. The state Supreme Court in Colorado says we have more free speech rights than the First Amendment, but the judge is now reconsidering whether the city of Aspen's public comment policy at housing is constitutional. He did rule that they violated our constitution by removing us and stopping us from speaking, and that we should be allowed as citizens to criticize our government. And we're very, very grateful for that.
Interesting case, Lee. It'll be interesting to see how they rule. They are allowed to regulate the way in which you express your free speech rights in government settings, the time, the place, the manner, and so on. But it'll be interesting to find out how that case turns out. We also welcome some more of your thoughts about the line in terms of where your First Amendment rights start and stop and the effort to figure that out. Or if you have questions about where the court might be heading as it relates to our First Amendment rights, now's a good time to ask. 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page, and we will put those questions to NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, who joins us now in studio. Nina, welcome.
Thank you. And who may not be able to answer them.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But you can answer about the Maynard case because you covered it in the 77. What else would you add in terms of the context of what the case meant or why the justices ruled the way they did?
I think this was not a difficult case for the justices actually at the time. It just was, as the guy said, sort of a progression. But as time has worn on, some of these cases have gotten more and more difficult. Lee, who just wrote to you, for example, those kinds of cases turn up all the time because Lee may not be a pain in the ass, but many people who attend public meetings are, and the city or the county or whatever finally says, you know, get this guy out of here. We're trying to do our business. And in addition to that, they almost always, the city or the county or the whatever, get their back up and do stupid things to the people who have been ejected or whatever. These cases come to the Supreme Court, and they are so complicated that the court dodges and weaves around them so that, at least so far, there's not a clear answer to Lee's situation. I wouldn't begin to describe that. But it's very interesting to me that the court has gotten, as it has gotten more and more conservative, and it's a very conservative court, it's gotten more and more purist about the First Amendment. And we see that in five members of the court overturning precedent to invalidate the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, or at least some of its major provisions. It views money as speech. Five members of the court do, and therefore it's basically Katie bar the door in terms of the amount of money that people spend and how they spend it in campaign financing. There used to be a very clear line at one point between commercial speech and personal speech. I would say that line is now very much blurred. And then, of course, we can throw in the computer, internet, whatever we call it, revolution, and how people's phones now carry all of their information. So if they stop you and want to look at your phone, which the Supreme Court has now said you can't do without a warrant, we have all new issues. Or you have issues like, well, who can you sue for libel? And can you sue Facebook instead of just the person who's put stuff on his Facebook page? Can you essentially sue the publisher? So far, not. The publisher are these large companies that are the vehicles. But I would not predict where this is going to go.
We also heard from several folks with strong feelings about another kind of frontier free speech that a lot of voters have been wrestling with. Here's what Bailey had to say.
I have a real serious problem with any kind of campaign or financial contributions being declared speech. because it creates an inherent inequity in that many people don't have the same kind of money that rich corporations and billionaires do. And so they're not going to have the same access. And, you know, that's just crap. The system was not designed to favor the rich that obviously, in my view. And that needs to go away. If it needs to be legislated out, then so be it. But, you know, speech is speech. We should all have the same amount and the same access.
Bailey, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Of course, Bailey's referring to the case Citizens United back in 2010. We had Floyd Abrams, who's a First Amendment scholar, on this program, and he explained that if you tell groups like Citizens United you can't spend your money to editorialize in this way, you have to be content neutral, and that means you'd have to say the same thing to other editorial outlets like the Wall Street Journal, like the Washington Post, like NPR, that anyone with that kind of size and heft and resources cannot editorialize in that way, hence the ruling in Citizens United. I'm interested, Nina, in how much more closely it seems people are paying attention to these First Amendment issues because, as you said, it's so much more complex. There are so many more ways for us to communicate, and so there are a lot more unanswerable questions or unanswered questions.
Well, I think that's true, but it's also true that I think people have a in modern America, have a much greater sense of self, of ego. I can do it. The Constitution says I can do it, so I can do it. And so, whereas when the case in New Hampshire came up, our Jehovah's Witness person was pilloried, lost his job, etc. And that was... It was very unusual that people would stand up. And it's not an accident that Jehovah's Witnesses had so many cases because this was so essential to their system of beliefs. Today, everybody thinks their systems of belief are sacred, sacred. And therefore, we see it's part of what's responsible for our polarization, too. I mean, it goes with the territory.
Bill emailed, "While listening to today's show, I was inspired to look at my Ohio license plates. The standard ones I have say, Ohio." Nina, Frederick emailed, "Does the current makeup of the Supreme Court raise the specter of abandoning precedent, such as with Justice Thomas's departure from res judiciata? I've never said res judiciata on NPR, but since this is NPR, I probably should have seen it coming. Can you explain Frederick's question to us?"
Well, he's worried that a lot of the Supreme Court's decisions that he likes might be overturned. And he has some reason to worry. The court is now more conservative, probably, than it's been in three quarters of a century.
And I beg your pardon. I mispronounced that.
Yes.
Clearly, I've never heard it. It's res judicata. It's the idea that a matter that...
I wasn't going to correct you on the air.
You would have been... Oh, you would have been perfectly entitled. It's this idea that a matter that another court has already adjudicated, that the same parties can't pursue it any further, that it's over.
Correct. So, and actually, there's been a study. It's interesting, because the court has been getting... more and more conservative every time somebody leaves the court for the last at least 20 or 30 years. Most of the time, that individual, as it happens, is replaced by a Republican president, and as that the individual replacing is far more conservative than the previous person. So, for example, when Justice O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor, left the court, she was replaced, and she was a sort of centrist conservative. And Justice Kennedy left in 2018, and he was a sort of centrist conservative. When they left, they were replaced by George W. Bush appointees who were far, far more conservative. Or in the case of Justice Kennedy, Trump appointees. So the court has gotten progressively more and more conservative. And what that means is that, and some of these conservatives, it's unclear how much they want to defer to precedent. There's been this study that I started out answering this question that shows that actually if you compare the Roberts Court from the time that he was appointed and previous courts, they reverse precedent at about the same rate. There's not a huge difference. The difference is that the previous courts, the Berger Court, the Rehnquist Court, the Warren Court, they did it with huge lopsided majorities, you know, 7-2, lots and lots of them unanimously. This court, and the Roberts Court has been doing it by 5-4 in the vast majority of cases.
Do you see the court, even as it's become more conservative, is it still as deliberative as it was? I mean, the Roberts Court has made some decisions that I think have upset some conservatives, including upholding the individual mandate in Obamacare by a 5-4 decision. And that's one of the reputations that the Supreme Court has had, that even if justices come from different political perspectives, they're still fair-minded, deliberative. They still hear each other out.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there's a difference between being partisan and being ideological. And people may not like it because conservatives are ideological and liberals are ideological. And some people are very wedded to a pretty rigid view of the law on either side, and others are not and are much more centrist. And at the moment, I would say the most ideological members of the court, for the most part, are on the right, and they've got the power. And that scares liberals. And it probably should. Liberals don't vote based on Supreme Court appointments. And the conservative Republican base does.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Carol emailed, I value free speech for many reasons. The thing that I do not understand, however, is when we stopped caring about the truth in advertising, especially in election-related ads. And I don't even care if the lies are being spread by the candidates themselves or merely by their supporters. Carol, you may want to check out a conversation we had today with Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner. He is concerned about this very thing. He is one of a number of senators who is concerned about this very thing. Check out that conversation a little bit later today online at the1a.org. The Supreme Court, Nina, recently started a new term. It's going to be hearing a number of contentious cases. One of them has to do with whether existing federal laws protect LGBTQ people under the protections against discrimination on the basis of sex. Where does that case stand, and are there any other cases, big ones, that we should be paying attention to this term?
Oh, there are a lot of other cases.
A lot of them.
This is going to be a gangbusters term. We have a big abortion case where the court could reverse precedent and step back from a decision just 3 years ago that protected clinics that perform abortions. We have the LGBTQ case involving whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bars discrimination based on sex, flatly no, the words of the statute clearly would bar any discrimination based on sex, but it's clear that legislators in 1964 didn't intend it to cover LGBTQ people. And so that case has already been argued. We have a case that a gun case, the first big gun regulation case in 10 years. We have the DACA case testing President Trump's rollback of protection for some 700,000 people who were brought here as children and have had temporary legal status because of an Obama administration program. We have a big separation of church and state case. I know I'm leaving something out.
There's that much.
There's that much. Cases that last year I would have spent a lot of time on. I don't have time for that. I don't know if you all watch Trevor Noah, and he says, we ain't got time for that. He's got to, right? I don't have time for that because there's so many bigger cases for me to have to pay attention to.
What's your sense from watching the oral arguments, from seeing the deliberations, in terms of how the newer justices, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, are making their mark on the court? They've certainly moved the court ideologically further to the right, but in terms of the tone of oral arguments, the deliberations, what impact are they having?
The tone of oral arguments is very, to use your word, deliberative. And they often, as I would say, many of the justices give a hard time to both sides. There are a couple of justices who really pound the whatever out of one side that they don't agree with. But most of them really do ask difficult questions of both sides. And most of the time, you get a sense of where it's going, but you can't be sure. Justice Kavanaugh, I think, is settled in pretty comfortably. He, after all, served on a court of appeals for more than a decade. And he is a person who likes to get along with people. He's an easy guy to be with, if you know what I mean. And he's easy on the bench. He's not mean to people. He asks questions much more in the sense of, but, you know, really, shouldn't I think that X? Justice Gorsuch, who preceded Kavanaugh as the other Trump nominee, I would say is less comfortable in his own skin in some ways. And so, although he's very gentlemanly most of the time, some of the questioning when he gets exercised about whether he's not he's getting an answer, it's just less comfortable. But the court seems to be collegial. They get along, at least on the surface. They're not what the court in the 1940s was once referred to as nine scorpions in a bottle. They're not like that. But I think that they have minimum high regard sometimes for each other's views on a few subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them might be campaign finance.
We'll see how that goes for sure. By the way, Nina, very briefly, how soon might we expect rulings on some of these cases?
Not soon. I would think not before spring. And, you know, the harder the case, the later it comes. The last 2 weeks in June are, you know, like horrific for me.
You will be very busy. That's NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, who you can also hear in the new podcast, Unprecedented. Nina, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me, Joshua.
We do hope you'll subscribe to Unprecedented from our colleagues here at WAMU. You can also subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you'd like. Please do write both of us reviews if you can. You'll find the links to listen to 1A at npr.org/1A. This conversation was produced by Orion Donovan Smith. To learn more about our team, visit the 1A.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.
Ain't nobody got time for that.